It's July 1996 in Pilanesberg National Park, a game reserve in South Africa, and ecologist Gus Van Dyke is driving at full speed through the park. The rangers have just discovered two dead bodies, and given what had just happened earlier that month, Gus feared the worst.
Earlier that month, a young elephant bull had chased after a group of tourists, but luckily no one was hurt or injured. This elephant had been causing trouble in the park for a while now, and staff knew it was time to put it down. So the very next day, a professional hunter was sent out to shoot it. But the elephant ended up killing the hunter, and now there's a report of two new bodies.
Gus spots the rangers and pulls his car to a stop in front of them. Together, the rangers and Gus walk a few meters into the bush, and Gus is shocked to see the carcasses of two decomposing white rhinos. He immediately assumes that this must have been the work of poachers, and then he sees that the rhino's horns are still intact. It's not poachers.
The rangers point out the puncture wounds along the carcasses, and it was immediately clear to Gus who the culprits were. Elephants.
From Triple E Media, I'm Ramat Mohammed, and this is The Backstory. Elephants are generally peaceful creatures, but between 1992 and 1996, that was not the case with the elephants at Pilanesberg. Almost overnight, the young male bulls had become aggressive, and their aggression had escalated to violence.
In the 4 years between 1992 to 1996, 23 rhinos had been gored to death by elephants at Pilanesberg. Some of the elephants even attempted to have sex with rhino cows. Now, this is highly unusual behavior for elephants, so Gus and his research team started to work to really get to the bottom of what was actually happening at Pilanesberg.
The first thing that they realized was that the male elephants, which were engaged in violent behaviors, were generally teenage elephants going through must. Must is a natural biological condition that affects male adult elephants. The period of must happens about 2 to 3 months every year. And during this time, the testosterone levels inside the male elephant body rises significantly, reaching up to 60 to 140 times its normal level.
When testosterone levels in the males go up during must, it means that it's mating time and the males become super active. But a male in must isn't just looking for a mate. No, he's out looking for a fight. A male in must has a bit more swagger than usual. He's more aggressive and unpredictable. And he's looking to display his dominance by fighting other males. Now, full-grown adult male elephants can still regulate this aggression and they know where to draw the line, especially when they've been part of the same herd for years and years. They don't just go around killing rhinos and human beings.
When young male bull elephants are between the ages of 10 to 15 years old, that's when they first start going into must. They start to release testosterone. Now, under normal circumstances, there are other older, more mature adult males that are part of the herd. And in the presence of these larger adult males who are also in must, the testosterone in the teenagers becomes suppressed. It gets shut down. Think about it. There's no way that the teenagers are going to win against the adult males, so why waste the energy to produce testosterone?
In a normal herd, the teenage bulls are not violent because the presence of the adult males suppresses this tendency. But the young male bull elephants at Pilanesberg National Park were not living as part of a normal herd. Their social structure had been disrupted, and that disruption started way back in 1981.
In 1981, Pilanesberg Park was looking to build up its elephant population, and the park was in luck. It turned out that another park, Kruger National Park, South Africa's largest park, they had too many elephants.
So a decision was made to relocate some of the elephants from Kruger to Pilanesberg. Because of the kinds of technology that existed during that time, it was virtually impossible to move the giant full-grown adult elephants. So the park officials decided to have the adults killed. The children, which were relatively smaller, were then moved to other parks. And in those other parks, including Pilinsberg, the young elephants grew into young bulls and they didn't have full-grown male adults around them.
So Gus Van Dyke and his team, they came up with a hypothesis. If the reason why the teenage males in Pilinsberg were behaving so erratically was because they lacked a male role model, then if they introduced full-grown males into the park, the problem should be solved. So between February and March 1998, the team brought in full-grown male elephants into the herd. And the result was outstanding. Within hours, the adult males had established their dominance, and the teenagers began to fall in line. They became less violent, and the amount of time they spent in must reduced. Now, ever since 1998, no rhino had been attacked and killed by an elephant. The natural balance had been restored. But not all of the elephants lived happily ever after. Some of them had to die.
So what does all this have to do with Nigeria? Obviously, we're not elephants, but we have our own version of what happened at Pilinsberg National Park.
Young men in the form of armed bandit groups have been running up and down West Africa, and they've been causing havoc, primarily in three countries, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Nigeria. Now, here in Nigeria, we tend to talk about our problems as if we're the only ones that are suffering. But if we spend just a few minutes Googling Burkina Faso and Mali, we'll see that the same exact pattern has been repeating in those countries. There's also similar activity in Niger, but some of that conflict may actually be spillover from Nigeria's side. So for the purpose of this discussion, we're going to focus on Mali, Burkina Faso, and Nigeria.
Now, a significant number of people believe the banditry problem in northern Nigeria is caused by politicians, and everyone has their favorite politician to blame. But no politician in Nigeria is powerful enough to orchestrate the events we're seeing unfold across West Africa, including northern Nigeria. The problems of northern Nigeria were caused by a series of forces, much larger than any one politician. And these forces have been building up since the 1990s.
And the young men causing all of this stress are in their 20s and 30s. So they would have been born somewhere between the 1990s and 2000s. In the 30 years between 1990 and 2020, these young men would have been witness to some significant changes in their social structure.
They would have witnessed overpopulation. Over the past 30 years, the populations in each of these countries, Nigeria, Mali, and Burkina Faso, have more than doubled.
They also would have witnessed climate change and its impacts. In the 1990s, the Mopti region of Mali and the Sahel region of Burkina Faso had about 310 days where the temperatures were at or above 32 degrees Celsius. By the year 2010, that number had gone up to 324 days, where the temperature was at 32 degrees or higher. This obviously means that they were experiencing shorter planting and harvesting seasons.
With overpopulation and climate change comes unemployment. Farming was no longer available, and the young boys who would have been occupied on the farm no longer had farms to go to.
Now, unemployment in any society is bad. But in the part of the world that we're talking about, that's northern Nigeria, Burkina Faso, and Mali, it's made even worse by the incredibly low levels of literacy. Literacy doesn't just mean the English language. Literacy means being able to read, write, and comprehend in any language. English, Arabic, Hausa, French, whatever the dominant language is of that region.
In Burkina Faso and Mali, only 20% to 25% of the population was literate in the 1990s. In 2018, that number rose to about 50% to 60%. So only half of the population in these two countries is literate. The literacy rate in all of Nigeria is 75%, but that number drops the further north you get, making northern Nigeria similar to Mali and Burkina Faso.
So now, on top of high unemployment and low levels of literacy, you now add democracy. And naturally, what you're going to get is corruption. Effective democracy assumes a high level of participation, which assumes a high level of literacy. The demos, or the people, are supposed to be a check and balance to government. But how can they do that when they are illiterate? Without the check and balance of literacy, corruption reigns.
The young men growing up in the 1990s and the 2000s in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Nigeria would have witnessed unbelievable levels of corruption. in every aspect of their lives, from their education systems to their welfare systems, and of course, the political systems.
So let's recap. We have hordes of young men, no work, illiterate, and living in a corrupt system. What do?
Well, they do what a lot of young men in Nigeria do. They leave, they emigrate, they jakpa, they seek greener pastures. Now, for some young men in Nigeria, greener pastures means Europe, the United States. But for other young men who don't have access to Europe, Nigeria is actually the greener pasture.
Okay, so now we have young men. Some have been displaced from communities in Burkina Faso and Mali, but others are internally displaced, for example, from the Northeast. Around the second quarter of 2018, they all begin to converge in the Northwest, specifically around Zamfara and Kaduna. Why those states?
Because there's gold in those states. Lots and lots of gold. In 2018, the price of gold on the market was anywhere between $1,200 to $1,400 per troy ounce. By 2020, the value of gold had risen to between $1,800 to $2,000 per troy ounce. I mean, once you start seeing that kind of money, why would you go back to the farm?
So if you're keeping track, we've got lots of displaced young men who have left their social structures for various different reasons. And into this mix, you now add gold, then you add weapons, and the result is banditry.
But it didn't stop there. It actually got much worse. In an effort to stop the banditry, some government officials in their magnanimity attempted to settle the bandits. So a string of payoffs began to happen, not just from governments, mind you. Even communities began to gather money to pay off the bandits.
But everyone knows that there is no honor among thieves and that you can never, ever pay off bandits. They always come back for more. So the cycle of banditry continued between the years 2018 and 2019.
But by 2020, signs began to emerge that jihadis had started to join forces with the bandits. And ever since then, we've seen a long string of kidnappings and attacks that are just growing bolder and bolder each time. Now, it's really easy to get lost in trying to understand which group is doing what, whether it's Boko Haram, Ansaru, or some other unknown group. But if you forget all those labels and you zoom out, one thing is very clear.
These are all young men in their 20s and 30s, operating without a social structure, just like the teenage elephants in Pilensburg. Now, in the case of the elephants, the park's management brought in 6 male bull elephants. These males were able to establish dominance and authority over some of the teenage elephants, and balance was restored. But some of the teenage males were too far gone. They were not ready to submit, and they simply had to be shot. Now, I'm not sure what the equivalent of bull elephants would be in northern Nigeria's case, but here's what I am sure of. Nature always has a way of restoring balance. Sometimes, like in the case of the Pilensburg elephants, nature relies on the research and wisdom of scientists to understand a situation and to do what it takes to restore balance in a controlled manner. But in the absence of wisdom and leadership, nature will always find other ways to restore balance. And her two most popular methods have been disease or war. The Backstory is a Triple E Media production. Production copyright 2022 Triple E Media Productions. If you enjoyed this episode of The Backstory and you would like to hear more, go to our website at 234audio.com to play the sample content. Then download our app from the Google Play Store for even more episodes. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at 234audio to watch the video for this episode. Make sure to click the notification bell, like, and leave a comment. Our episodes can also be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe, like, and leave a comment. This episode of The Backstory was produced by Ramat Muhammad, Alexandra Gekpe, Uche Mba, Dominic Tabakaji, and Sam Tabakaji. Executive Producer Ramat Muhammad. Special thanks to John Iwoji and Mala Iwa Bado Ikaleku.